This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll learn about the first folio, the first collected edition of William Shakespeare's plays, many of which were not published during his lifetime. A copy is on exhibit now in Wisconsin. First, opiate addiction has quickly become a growing epidemic in Wisconsin and other parts of the country, often in rural areas. The road to recovery is difficult. These addictions often begin at a young age with a routine doctor's prescription. Molly Herman joins us now. She's the director, writer, and co-producer of Written Off, a documentary about a Wisconsin man's 10-year struggle to escape opiates and the stigma that can surround addiction. Here's a clip from the film's trailer, which is premiering in Wisconsin at the Wyawega International Film Festival this weekend.
He said the strangest thing. He said, "If anything happens to me, the journals will explain everything." And I'm like, "What are you talking about will explain everything?" And then he just kind of says, "Well, I write everything that happens in there every day. So if anything were to happen to me, I would write about it, and you would know what happened."
There is no real way out. If you have access, you have problems.
Molly Herman, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Well, I understand this issue is personal to you. You lost someone in your family to an opiate addiction.
I did. I lost my cousin, Emily, to the same problem, but a long time ago. And when it just was an issue that we didn't really recognize in our family, you know, we sort of talked about her problems, like they were emotional problems. And, you know, later on when this opiate crisis became a crisis, and I started to learn more about it, I looked back at that and thought, oh, that wasn't just crazy Emily. That was an addiction story. That's what happened. And I don't think any of us really knew what was going on.
And what drew you to this story here in Wisconsin, one man who dealt with addiction, ultimately died?
Yeah, I've been looking around for, you know, something that kind of told this story in a really personal way, because in my family, we don't talk about this issue, I don't think, enough. And, you know, it seemed like something that was blamed on the person that it happened to and to her immediate family. And, you know, I was really interested in kind of exploring it from the inside out. So I had, you know, been kind of clicking around everywhere on the web, and I had found this In Memoriam page where Matt's mom, Jane, had posted a photograph of him. And I clicked through, and I found her blog, which she had called My Dead Son's Journals, which caught my attention. And what she'd been doing, as a school project, was posting pages, you know, typing up and posting pages from his journals. And I started reading them, you know, and realized that this was sort of what I was looking for, and also that it had attracted a lot of people who were struggling with these same issues, and they would write kind of back and forth, and Jane would write to them. And, you know, it was clear to me that people for whom this was really real saw themselves in his story.
We'll get into Matt's story a little more, but just even I've seen the trailer, and it was heartbreaking. You're looking at people here who, if we in the public hear about them, they're part of a statistic of opiate addictions and fatalities. They're, you know, the crime story, maybe they're a public health issue. You're bringing us Matt, a person, a real human being.
Yeah, you know, I felt like for a while, every time I'd open my computer, the New York Times homepage would pop up, and it would be a mugshot of another person. And the reporting was always the same. You know, it was always like, happy, middle class, so-and-so, in jail. And I think there's a reason for that. I think that people like to sort of see other people fall down, and it makes them feel like they're less likely to or something. But it's not selective, this problem. It's really lots of people, there's not a lot of you know, there's some personal responsibility for getting into it or getting lost in it, I guess, but it's really sort of equal opportunity. And you know, it's so easy to to blame people dealing with addiction, and even easier because the addiction problem makes them really, you know, their struggle to survive, they end up telling lots of lies and wild stories and, you know, kind of making themselves obnoxious in a way that their families are, you know, just beaten up by. And so, you know, I sort of feel like it's like, you know, nobody in this country ever blames someone who smokes 3 packs a day when they get lung cancer. Everyone feels sympathetic toward them, you know. And so even if you did experiment with drugs or use drugs and then got addicted, you know, that piece seemed to be missing to me. And, you know, everybody out there that's dealing with this is somebody's kid, is somebody's brother, sister, daughter, or mother. And, you know, that's what I wanted to talk about.
Talking to Molly Herman, creator of Written Off, a documentary about a Wisconsin man who was addicted to opiates, recorded his addiction in a journal and passed away ultimately. Molly, tell us about Matt. You read his journals. You met his mom. You talked to her. You talked to friends. Who was Matt?
Well, you know, excuse me. I think Matt was a guy who, you know, what really struck me was how much potential he had. That he was really sort of smart. People described him as, you know, kind of overly adult for his age. I think he was kind of like a big thinker stuck in a town so small it didn't even have a store, you know. And he just was an unusual guy, and I think he was a little awkward in his skin, and I think that's why he ended up in this cycle. But everybody who sees his journal pages, which we feature in the film, always asks me, is that really his writing? Because he had sort of neat writing and really was very faithful in trying to sort out his feelings and record the things that were happening to him and in a really thoughtful way. And I think the best of him ended up on those pages in a lot of ways.
And what's heartbreaking, just seeing some of the pages, he would detail what he had taken, what he had used. And this is, I should say, after it was initially a prescription for a toe infection or something like that, where he had gotten his first prescription and he was hooked right off the bat, right?
Yeah, I mean, a lot of people have this similar trajectory. They'll have some sort of surgery, and there hasn't been a lot of awareness. In fact, these drug companies have marketed their opioid painkillers on the principle that they're not addictive, which has been, you know, there's been a lawsuit about it. It's something that's really been very insidious and affected a lot of people. In Matt's case, I wouldn't say he got addicted from his first prescription, but he liked it a lot. He got exposed to it.
I see.
And, you know, he was a kid and, like a lot of kids, thought that anything that was a prescription was safe. Otherwise, why would your doctor give you a big bottle of it? And so he took those pills. He got better from his foot surgery, and then he started looking for those pills and buying them and eventually needing them.
So
and yeah.
In his journal, he details, took these pills, injected this, measuring amounts, measuring the cost, and often it seems like at the bottom of the page, this has got to stop. I've got to stop this. He knew this was bad, and he couldn't stop.
Oh, no, he could not stop. And he was even in rehab for a short period of time, and then he fell back into it. You know, the sort of chemistry, sort of brain science behind it is that these drugs sort of make your brain forget how to be happy on its own, because they're pumping out the same chemicals that do that. And when you stop taking them, you get really depressed. And then life seems so bleak, you figure, maybe I'll just do the drugs again. So it's really tough to break out of, and he tried so hard. And I guess one of the shockers for me was that I sort of assumed that addiction was about, like, getting high in for fun. And that was not really the case in his life. You know, he mostly was getting high to not get sick.
Mm-hmm.
And he would go on these little campaigns where he would write down everything and try. He was trying to convince himself, you know, to have the fortitude to stop by seeing that, you know, he didn't have any money, even though he was working, you know, three shifts a day, because he was spending so much money on drugs, hundreds of dollars a day sometimes. I mean, this was a guy who worked at McDonald's and Pizza Hut and a Mexican restaurant.
Molly, before we let you go, you've had this story in your family. You've told Matt's story. We get callers whenever we talk about heroin. We hear from people this is an issue in their families. What you've been through, what you've seen putting this documentary together, what do you want families to take away from this?
Well, I think you said it yourself. You know, he knew what he was doing was wrong. And that's sort of what his mom says in the film, too. You know, all I knew how to do was come at him, you know, wagging my finger and telling him he was wrong and telling him he had to stop. And that wasn't the right way to approach it. He knew. He told a whole bunch of lies so that he could keep on doing it. He couldn't break out of that cycle. He needed real help. And I've talked to some addiction doctors that always say to me, you know, oh, I wish I'd known him. And I know that help can be hard to find and those resources can be hard to find, but it's a long-term issue. And people who are wrapped up in it, they already know it's bad. And they need, I think, more understanding.
We'll leave it there for now, Molly. Thanks a lot for joining us.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me.
That's Molly Herman, director, writer, and co-producer of Written Off. It's a documentary film about a Wisconsin man's 10-year struggle with opiate addiction, the stigma that surrounds his addiction, his ultimate death. Madison was chosen as one of the national sites for displaying one of William Shakespeare's most treasured books. The first folio, published in 1623, was the first collected edition of Shakespeare's plays, many of which were not published during his lifetime. The rare book will be on display at the Chazen Museum of Art in Madison until December 11th. Joining us now to tell us more about this rare exhibit is Joshua Calhoun. He's an assistant professor of English at UW-Madison and faculty affiliate with the Nelson Institute for Environmental Studies. Joshua, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks, Rob. Good to be here.
Well, tell us about this first folio, how it came into being, its significance.
Yeah, no, it's an amazing opportunity for us to have it here so that people can come see look at it in the Chazen and understand, you know, we don't think about the book as a technology, but it is an important technology. It's a technology that allowed Shakespeare to do the reading that he did to collect the ideas that came to him so that he could put them into written form, into plays and into poetry. And it's a large book. It's funny the way you can think about the size of it. You think about four mass market paperbacks, maybe copies of Louis L'Amour. My basketball coach used to love those. He put four of them on the table, two side by side, and up and down, you've got the size of that folio. So it's about 9 by 14 inches, and it would weigh about 4 pounds. About 900 pages in it, and it's a massive book that takes all of Shakespeare's known plays at the time, 36 plays, 18 of which hadn't been printed before. So the reason the exhibit is called The Book That Gave Us Shakespeare is because there's presumably these 18 plays, some of which many people have probably heard of, like Macbeth, or Antony and Cleopatra, Julius Caesar, among the comedies,
some big names
As You
there.
Like It. Yeah, Comedy of Errors, Twelfth Night we wouldn't have, and one of my favorites, The Tempest, we wouldn't have, perhaps, if this... If this volume hadn't been printed, because they'd been printed in a smaller format, half of them had, but half of them had never been printed before, and this printed them and preserved them in a way that we still are able to be saving and keeping from biodeteriorating.
Wow. So if they hadn't published this back in 1623... A third, I don't know, of Shakespeare's plays would be gone to us?
Really, I mean, half of what we know, we've added to, there's a couple more that come into play, but, you know, the other thing that they don't, I'll tell you, your listeners, something that's not part of the, I haven't been seeing it really passed around officially, I think it's an important thing. You know, King John is one of those plays that we would have lost, and I don't have a ton of affection for King John. I'm going to be perfectly honest with you. I'm sorry to listeners who do. But we would have lost the chorus to Henry V. That chorus that was, when Henry V was printed in the quarto, it didn't have that O for a Muse of Fire, right? The talking about cramming into a wooden O the casks of France. And so that... those lines, that opening chorus that people associate with Henry V, that also was not in that early edition and wouldn't have, we might not have had if not for the folio, which I would trade King John for the chorus from Henry
V. Wow, okay. Now tell us about the origin story of the first folio. What do we know about Who put it together? Why it ended up being published?
Yeah, we know that John Hemming and Henry Condell, two fellow actors in Shakespeare's acting company, put it together 7 years after his death. They present it as a monument. It's to the great variety of readers, although it would have been expensive for somebody to buy. It's put together as a monument. They collect poetry in the front of it from the likes of Ben Jonson. Jonson famously says he's not of an age, but for all time in the dedicatory poem. This famous image by Martin Droschut, that's this, it really is a fairly sort of not particularly flattering image of Shakespeare, but it's an iconic image that we all, you know, see used for memes. And
if we try to picture Shakespeare in our minds, that's the picture
that's
that
the image.
Is the source of that.
That's right. Right. And then it always gets played with, right, which is the brilliant part of it. Recently, somebody posted something to me, you know, that one with Shakespeare with a cheese head on. You know, you could put a party hat on, right? It's this image that we play with Shakespeare in our head. But yeah, that's the iconic image. And they put it together as a way, you know, what they say is to make Shakespeare available to be read. Obviously, most of these were being performed on the stage or had been performed on the stage, but now it's an opportunity to go deeper, to read, and you get a lot of changes come into the text, and so this leaves plenty of scholars a lot of work to do and to write books on.
As I understand the way plays work, I'm not a theater person myself, but they might be revised from show to show by Shakespeare and his actors, like, oh, that line didn't work, this one got laughs, let's do more with that. So at some point, somebody is making an editorial decision. What's the final version of a Shakespeare play that we're going to publish?
That's right, and I think, you know, some people... I don't tend to get bent out of shape about the changes. I kind of love the way that ideas change when they come into different media. Mm-hmm. You know, radio. This is my first live interview, Rob. I've never done this. It's a different format. I know you can't go back and edit if I say something really stupid, which makes me nervous. In the same way,
I'm nervous too. Thanks.
Yeah, right. You know, you've got a live play, and it's something very different on the stage, the Globe Theater. Now you take it and you put it into a book form. I've been talking about it a little bit in some of the talks I've been giving about containers. I have a couple different favorite coffee mugs. You know, one's like a little bit too small, but it's really cool, and my daughter made it for me, and one's like the perfect size, but it's fragile. And these are different containers. They all hold the coffee, but they do something different. They represent something different. The stage, when you go out to APT, you hear the play, you see it, that's one thing, but to be able to read it, to go back through those lines, you get a different experience. Mm-hmm. So the folio next door at the Chazen Museum, next door from us right now, is one container that has preserved Shakespeare, preserved his words across time.
Talking to Joshua Calhoun from UW-Madison about the first folio, this collection of Shakespeare plays published in 1623, one of the remaining editions. What was the print run on something like this, and how many have survived to this day?
That's a great question. So it's actually not a rare book by almost any standard. Mm-hmm. We believe that about 750 were printed. We can be reasonably confident no more than 1,000 were printed. Of that number, we know of 235 that survive today. And if you start thinking of private collectors, maybe 250. So it's quite possible a third of them survive. Mm. But, you know, I looked up the first generation iPod from 15 years ago. Mm. On eBay, you can get it for about $115. Or you can get this unopened package of it for $20,000, right? So the folio comes in a lot of different states. There are different, they've been cut apart. The Folger Shakespeare Library has 82 first folios, but only 13 of those are complete. So they're in different states, and we recognize, like a first-generation iPod, that it's an historic piece of technology. But it depends on the wear and tear. And what's interesting is, if you ask me, I'd like the one that's been used, that's all scratched up, because you can see how people use that technology. I think that's really interesting, as opposed to the ones in the box still.
Now, this came from, you mentioned the Folger Library Collection. They've decided to put this one edition on tour, right? And why Madison? Why was the Chazen selected?
Yeah, well, largely because of a lot of work by people here, especially headed up by Susan Baraboo at the libraries. And she put in this grant. She pulled together a whole team of interdisciplinary scholars who have different interests in this folio for different reasons. The Chazen said, you know, we can host this object here. They usually do, you know, they're not usually hosting books next door at the Chazen, but they've done this amazing poster collection around it. And they've got this just really wonderful exhibit space that they could put it in. I think that we were able to convince them that they should bring it here. And I also think, you know, the director of the Folger, Mike Whitmore, is a former faculty here. I don't think we got any favors, but
Insider trading,
I do think that, you know, he must have felt a little support for us.
Now, when we go in to see it, it might be worth a repeat visit, right? Because it's going to be open to different pages as the exhibit goes along?
It's actually going to be open to the same, page,
the same page,
as I understand.
Okay.
It's going to be open to the little-known speech, To Be or Not to Be. That is the question from Hamlet. And it'll be interesting to see, though. You'll see how it's split across columns in the page in a way you would sort of almost imagine iconically in the middle of the page. It'll be interesting to see it, to see how it's printed. And one of the fun things is you'll have long S's, which look like F's, mm-hmm. and so you'll see things that look like fleep, like to die, to fleep, and readers, I like watching
people.
That's
not millennial slang.
It's not millennial slang. Maybe it will be fleek, you know, who knows, but I think it's a lot of fun to watch people try to figure out that technology.
Now, you teach a class, I understand, on Shakespeare and the media. Tell us a little about that.
Yeah, I'm co-teaching that course with friend and colleague Jonathan Senshin, who's in the library sciences, and he's we're really helping students to think through how Shakespeare gets to us. I always have this kind of shtick, you know, we all do, but I talk to students about, you know, if you have a really good idea, whether you're Galileo or Shakespeare or Marie Curie, you have a great idea and you want to share it with other people across time, like 100 years later, you have to figure out how to hold that idea in your hand and share it with others. And the folio is one example of how you can hold Shakespeare and share it, but so is the smartphone. And so we're trying to help students think about how their own ideas are mediated by thinking, well, is it Shakespeare's mediated across time and remediated and remixed?
All right, what is next? What else is going on at this exhibit of the first folio between now and December 11th?
So there are a few different events. I know my colleague Stephanie Elski is doing a talk next week, and there's a lot of different there's a Global Hotspot talk I'm doing. We have Falstaff here. Verdi's Falstaff is going on Friday and Sunday and Tuesday. And then the other thing that's worth noting is if you really like the book, go next door to the Memorial Library. Special Collections has a second, third, and fourth folio on display, along with other really wonderful books from the 16th and 17th century that will set the context of the world into which the folio was printed.
Joshua, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you.
That's Joshua Calhoun, assistant professor of English at UW-Madison. He's been telling us about Shakespeare's first folio, this early collection after Shakespeare passed away of many of his plays. You can see that on display at the Chazen Museum of Art in Madison until December 11th. Most polls leading up to Tuesday's presidential election consistently predicted a win for Hillary Clinton. And predictions like those led to a big surprise for many voters from both political parties who woke up on Wednesday to find Donald Trump the new president-elect of the United States. There were similar upsets at the state level where polls predicted a win for Russ Feingold over Ron Johnson in the U.S. Senate race. So what happened? Charles Franklin joins us now. He's a professor of law and public policy at Marquette University and director of the Marquette Law School Poll. He's also the co-founder of Pollster.com and founder of PollsandVotes.com. Charles, welcome back to the show.
Good to be here.
Let's start with a basic question on many people's minds. How did the polls apparently get it as wrong as they did?
Well, we did. And, you know, that's an important first step, is to say we got the wrong winner. That's a big surprise. There are two things here that, excuse me, Rob, I'm still coughing.
You're doing a lot of talking this week, I'm sure.
Yes. Especially with the presidential race. My last poll had Clinton ahead by 6. It looks like Trump was winning by 1. That's a big discrepancy, not just the wrong winner, but also numerically a big discrepancy from the outcome. But we were lucky this year to have a lot of polls by other organizations also working in the state. And the average across those polls was a 5.8 Clinton margin. So, in a way, it would be better if only my poll had been wrong, mm-hmm. because that would just be one poll and the rest were right, and it was, you know, just one bad poll. But over the entire year, not a single poll done in Wisconsin showed Trump winning. And the average was 5.8, and if you look at the most recent polls, there were 6 and 7 and 5. And so they were very consistent there. That shows that something systematically went wrong rather than that one single poll went wrong. As for what? Well, one possibility is people changed their minds late. And we actually do see that in the Wisconsin exit poll, that 14% said they decided in the last week, and they went for Trump by a 59% to 30% margin. A very big late break for Trump, and something that occurred after all the other polls were conducted in the state. So that's one part. The other is, did we identify likely voters accurately? That's something that we're working on still. We'll have some quick answers in another day or two, but a lot of those answers are going to have to wait until things like the final certification of the vote and especially the updating of the voter list, the registered voter list, which will take several months to complete.
Now, that's in Wisconsin you're focusing on. Wisconsin presidential race, there was a similar story in many other battleground states. Hillary Clinton in the lead in polls, Donald Trump winning maybe a narrow victory. Is there some kind of systematic problem that would be likely to happen in state polling in a lot of different states?
Well, demonstrably there were. The Pennsylvania and Michigan polls were just about as far off as the Wisconsin polls were on the average across all the polls. Other states that were simply close had polls that generally were also close. So North Carolina, the polling was mostly close. Ohio, the polling was mostly close. So where we're really seeing these big discrepancies are in especially these three Midwestern states that went for Trump, though I might add Minnesota in the mix, even though Clinton won it narrowly. We'd like to look there and see if this has something to do with the kinds of states we are, the kind of demographic makeup we have. And that would put that would point to voters who were either being missed in our likely voter models or late breaking opinion among certain groups. The exit polls will help us identify those things. And as I say, there will be other data that comes in over the next few months that lets us look at new voters and also look at people who dropped out of the electorate after having voted in, say, 2008 and 2012. But that project, those kinds of data are going to take several months before they're available.
Talking to pollster Charles Franklin from Marquette University about discrepancies between pre-election polls and the actual election results. Charles, looking at the overall national popular vote numbers, it looks like they weren't that crazy far off. A national polling showing, leads for Hillary Clinton, maybe 3 or 4% were some of the last ones I saw. She ended up winning the popular vote for what that's worth, not much, but they were only really a couple percentage points off when it all is said and done.
That's right, and that will be one of the, if you want to call it a bright spot of the polls, is that the national data overstated her vote by a little bit, but not by a lot. Now, the fact that Trump wins the Electoral College and the presidency is a pretty big, important thing. But, the national polls aren't trying to measure that. The national polls are looking at the overall national vote, and it does appear that Clinton will win that by a million or so votes once all of the late votes are tallied.
I want to ask a question about why we poll. I saw a John Cohen from SurveyMonkey. They've been working on polling, talking about, hey, it's important that we look at what happened here, get it right. And I'm quoting now, public opinion work is too important to our democracy and too important to understanding ourselves and our society to fade away. That's not your quote, Charles, but do you want to defend that? Do you want to back it up? Is public opinion work, are these polls important to our democracy?
No, I certainly support that argument. There are a couple of things. One is, of course, none of us want to be wrong, and there's going to be a lot of effort to see what went wrong and how we change it. Some of that could be really easy. If late-breaking vote decisions are dramatically different, like they appear to be, according to the exit polls, then that's a fairly easy problem. We just need to poll through the weekend before the election. So we could do that pretty easily. But if there are types of voters that we're systematically missing, maybe because they don't want to do polls, they're not available for pollsters, But in the past, it didn't matter because they weren't voting much. If they voted now in this election for the first time, that's a big deal, and we need to work, and that's a harder problem to fix. But I think what Cohen says that I really resonate to is, of course, the horse race matters a lot and gets a lot of attention, but polls are a way for the public to speak, a way to give everyone an equal chance to be represented in the poll and to have their say and to be reported as this percentage favors one thing and that percentage favors another. It's a part, just a part, but a part of the public dialogue in how we talk to each other and how we develop a democracy where citizens hear each other's opinions. So in that way, I'm very much with Cohen. We're, as pollsters, at least partly thinking that we're helping democracy in that way. And that remains an important part of the polling enterprise.
Let me throw maybe a mini hypothesis at you about this particular election where you had two major party candidates with historically high negatives. A lot of people didn't like them, but maybe a lot of people are thinking, I'm going to vote, I'm civically minded, I'm going to vote, and I want my vote to go to a candidate who's going to win. Maybe a lot of these people decided as they were filling out the ballot. I mean, maybe that poll even the day before the election wouldn't have helped that much. And something about those candidates made more of them break toward Donald Trump in the final analysis. Is that something that's going to just foil polling accuracy? It's going to add some uncertainty?
Well, I'm not quite prepared to go to spoil it, but it's certainly a part of the issue, because if that's the dynamic in the polling, in the voting booth, then short of pollsters following you into the voting booth, we're not going to get that. But there's some evidence for what you say and that it mattered a lot in the exit polls on a number of questions. They asked about opinions of Clinton and Trump. So is your opinion favorable or unfavorable to each? And other things, qualified for president and so on. Of the group that said they had a unfavorable opinion of both Clinton and Trump, Donald Trump got 58% of that vote, Hillary Clinton 22%. And so there's a category of negative to both, but the vote overwhelmingly went to Trump rather than Clinton. That's another way that we see how either people were more willing to forgive Trump for his shortcomings, or perhaps thought Hillary Clinton's shortcomings were somehow more serious. But it's clear that we're seeing a very large, almost 3-to-1, certainly 2-to-1, more than 2-to-1 advantage for Trump in those situations where 22% of the public had a negative view of both. But in the end, rather than staying home, they came to the polls and they gave substantially more support to Trump.
We're talking about the discrepancies between the outcome of the election and the polls preceding it with Charles Franklin, professor of law and public policy at Marquette University and director of the Marquette Law School poll. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Were you surprised, like many people in both parties, by the difference between the poll results and election outcome? How do you account for that? Or what do you want to ask Charles Franklin about that? Were you addicted to the polls through this last week, last bunch of months, last year? Call in at 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We continue our examination of the discrepancy between the outcome of the election and the poll predictions leading up to it. You can join in at 800-642-1234, post on the Central Time Facebook page, or tweet us at Central Time WPR. Charles Franklin stays with us from Marquette University, director of the Marquette Law School poll. And we'll go to your calls now with Greg in McHenry, Illinois. Greg, hi.
Hello, how are you?
Good. What did you want to bring up?
Yep, so I had one quick comment for Charles, and that would be, what is the real purpose of the poll? That would be number one. And two, if the poll is for the people more so, would it also not be for the candidates? Because if they knew that they were behind in a state, they'd be able to spend more money.
Greg, thanks for the call. Charles,
sure.
Who uses polls for what?
Those are both great questions. Let me answer the second one first. The candidates have far more polling than I have. You know, they have millions and millions of dollars behind their polling operations. And so, really, the issue is not, is our polling affecting the candidates, but rather if we, and I mean that collectively, pollsters in general, not just my poll, if there weren't those public polls, then it would only be the candidates and the parties that knew what public opinion was doing, and there'd be no one to present that data, because obviously the campaigns are only going to let out what they want to let out. So that's why I think it's important, and to answer your first question, that there be a source not connected to the parties or the candidates or the interest groups who do their own polling, but who can provide information about what the public is thinking. So right now, one of the questions is going to be what happens to the Affordable Care Act, Obamacare. The Senate Majority Leader said that they would move to repeal that. Well, we have polling that shows opinion fairly divided, a little bit more opposed to the Affordable Care Act rather than in favor. But we also have data that shows that when you ask, what do you want to do, the public is quite divided on that, with a fair number of people saying they want to expand it. We wouldn't know that if there weren't independent polls being conducted to address this policy issue. You know, it'll ultimately be up to the elected officials about what they want to do about policy, but the polling helps us understand whether the public is lopsided on one side or another, or pretty evenly divided, as it happens to be on health care reform.
Back to our callers with John in La Crosse. John, hi.
Questions about the sampling pools. I guess my question would be, how is the information obtained during the poll? Is it done exclusively through landlines? And if so, wouldn't that skew the demographics and then also cause maybe a potential problem with the sampling pool, because the demographics of landline use would not include, you know, millennials potentially and other groups of people?
John, that's a question a lot of people are asking. Let me throw in another wrinkle. D-emails, I'm not one to answer any kind of poll. I hung up on the calls. And then, of course, we've got internet polling coming in. Charles, it's a different age. People aren't answering their landlines at home anymore. Right. How is that affecting polling?
Right. So let me answer John's question first. We include cell phones. Half of our respondents are on cell phone, half are on landline. You're dead right that there's a big difference. Trying to find anybody under about 45 on a landline is really hard. But that's why we interview half by cell. And the best statistics show that that's about where cell phone only usage is. So we're representing the cell phones. And the way it's sampled is to give every phone number in the state an equal chance of being called, whether it's a landline or a cell phone. So we do that quite well, and all the media polls now include cell phones in all of their samples. So we've gotten past the cell phone problem. We still have the problem of people not picking up or hanging up, as you just said. There, the issue is that at least up until now, we've had good evidence that Democrats and Republicans alike both hate telemarketers and so tend not to pick up the phone or not to complete the interview. And because it's bipartisan, we really don't see a partisan bias in the responses. The fact that we got these errors this time does raise the question of, is it possible that, that some set of Trump supporters also consistently refuse to do the poll in a disproportionate way compared to Clinton supporters not doing the poll? And that's something we'll examine very closely going forward, something we've been looking for all year and not found much evidence for. But now, in the wake of these polling errors, I will go back and give it a much more fine-tooth-combed examination.
John, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. We're talking with Charles Franklin from the Marquette University and the Marquette Law School Survey. Go back to our callers now. Scott is with us in Madison. Scott, hi.
Hi. Hey, Charles. Is there any thought to it, maybe, with all the polls that are out and all the information,
I know they do them pretty close right up to the election day, but do you think people might be swayed at all when they hear, you know, 5%, 6%, 7% projected lead? That somebody might say, well, you know, if somebody has a 6, 7% lead, do I even really need to go out and vote? Is it worth it because they already got this wrapped up?
Yeah, that's a good question, too. And it's something that pollsters do fret about. I certainly do, and encourage people not to listen to my poll on that. Go out and vote. Here's the best evidence on it. When we look at polling done since 1998 up through at least last time, where the polls show somebody ahead by 6 or 8 or 10 points, the outcome of the election is still pretty close to that 6 or 8 or 10. If people were being discouraged from voting because they thought their guy had it sewn up, then we would see the actual vote be closer than what the poll showed. And conversely, another plausible story, if people like to jump on a bandwagon, you'd expect to see them actually get more of the vote than what the polls show. And at least before this year, there was not a consistent movement above or below the polls. On average, they were quite close to the outcome. So that's the reason I don't think there's much discouragement or perhaps encouragement of voting when you see a margin in the polls.
Scott, thanks. We'll go to Rachel in Bayfield next. Rachel, hi.
Hi.
What do you want to tell us about?
I was going to mention how I had planned to vote defensively against Trump and go with Hillary, but once I got into that booth, I couldn't rightfully vote for Hillary either, and I changed my mind and went Green Party at the last minute. And I know that was one thing my teenage daughter was so upset about. Like, why would you vote for someone that's not going to win? But I know in my heart and kind of knowing what was right, it was a last-minute change for me.
Rachel, thanks for the call. I imagine maybe it's not always Clinton to Stein, but there are voters out there who think they have their mind made up and have that voting booth crisis.
I think that's certainly reasonable. In the exit poll, of the 16% who said neither Clinton nor Trump was qualified to be president, Trump got 63% to Clinton's 15%, but Gary Johnson got 16% and Jill Stein 4%. So that's 20% of the public that were dissatisfied with both major candidates and chose to go with one of the third-party candidates. And that's, you know, that's fine. These people don't own your vote. If they haven't earned it, giving it to someone else seems to me a perfectly reasonable thing. But it's a large magnitude here of 20% of folks unhappy with both candidates that chose a third party this time, just as Rachel did.
We'll leave it there for now. Charles, thanks a lot for taking the time with us today.
Always a pleasure, Rob. Thanks.
That's Charles Franklin, professor of law and public policy at Marquette University, director of the Marquette Law School Poll. He also founded PollsandVotes.com and co-founded Pollster.com.